This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent wherever they live upon the earth, and also important to all people. Today's an important day. We're going to continue on with the audio version of my book, Jewish Supremacism, the final part of Chapter 13, The Jewish-Led Invasion. I believe this is one of the most vital chapters in my book, and it's so important for people to understand the hypocrisy when it comes to Jewish extremism, Jewish supremacism. They want a nation of Israel only for Jews, a, quote, Jewish state. They have a very strict immigration Jewish-only policy. They make Jewish-only settlements. They do not allow for legal marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew. And yet at the same time, they work relentlessly to break down the ethnic cohesiveness, the homogeneity of other nations. As this chapter will show, it's because they see this as their own strategic advantage in this conflict, this war between Jew and Gentile that they believe is waging. And if you take a look at it, it does seem indeed to be waging. However, we're not aware of it, but they seem to be very aware that they're concerned about their interests. And one of their interests is to break down the cohesiveness of other countries. So this is the final part of Chapter 13, The Jewish-Led Invasion. And I think you'll find it one of the more fascinating and in some ways frightening chapters of my book, Jewish Supremacism. In 1951, Jacob Javits authored an article called Let's Open Our Gates. It called for massive unrestricted immigration. Javits and Representative Seller figured prominently in the passage of the bill in 1965. 9 years before passage of the 1965 Immigration Act, the American Jewish Congress initially proposed the essential elements of the bill and praised President Eisenhower for his unequivocal opposition to the national quota system. In a 1956 editorial, they praised him for courageously taking a stand in advance of even many advocates of liberal immigration policy and embraced a position which had first been urged by the American Jewish Congress and other Jewish agencies, unquote. Jewish motivation behind open immigration is the next section. Now, it would have been stupid and counterproductive for the Jewish organizations that have pushed for open borders to admit that they were motivated by interests that conflicted with those of non-Jewish Europeans. They promoted open immigration as patriotic. From the early days of the century, they made public pronouncements that multiculturalism and diversity would be beneficial to the United States, clearly masking their strategic motivations. After the passage of the Open Immigration Statutes of 1965, Jewish authors such as Naomi Cohen felt much safer in revealing some of the real Jewish reasons for promoting such policy. She wrote that, beginning with the persecutions of Russia in the 1880s, through the Nazi occupation of Europe and into the Cold War tribulations in Eastern Europe, open immigration in Western nations served Jewish interests because, quote, survival often dictated that Jews seek refuge in other lands, unquote. Cohen also wrote that a U.S. internationalist foreign policy serves Jewish interests because, quote, an internationally minded America was likely to be more sensitive to the problems of foreign Jewries, unquote. Perhaps even more important, Cohen intimated that Jews saw open immigration policies as breaking down the homogeneity and unity of America, creating a pluralistic society in which Jews could thrive. In his monumental book, A History of Jews in America, Howard Sacker notes that pluralism supports, quote, legitimizing the preservation of a minority culture in the midst of a majority's host society, unquote. So in effect, by breaking down the integrity and cohesion of America, Jews could increase their integrity and cohesion and power. Sackert goes on to explicitly show how pluralism intensifies Jewish solidarity. Quote, "But Callan's influence extended really to all educated Jews, legitimizing the preservation of a minority culture in the midst of a majority's host society. Pluralism functioned as intellectual anchorage for an educated Jewish second generation, sustained its cohesiveness and its most tenacious communal endeavors through the rigors of the Depression and revived anti-Semitism. Through the shock of Nazism and the Holocaust until the emergence of Zionism in post-World War II years swept through American Jewry with a climactic redemptionist fervor of its own." Social psychologist Kevin MacDonald pointed out in A People That Shall Dwell Alone that major anti-Semitic movements are usually found in ethnically homogeneous nations and that, quote, "ethnic and religious pluralism serves external Jewish interests because Jews become just one of many ethnic groups and it becomes difficult or impossible to develop unified, cohesive groups of Gentiles united in their opposition of Judaism," unquote. In his 1985 book, A Certain People, American Jews and Their Lives Today, Charles Silberman writes that, quote, "American Jews are committed to cultural tolerance because of their belief, when firmly rooted in history, that Jews are safe only in a society acceptant of a wide range of attitudes and behaviors, as well as diversity of religious and ethnic groups. It is this belief, for example, not approval of homosexuality, that leads an overwhelming majority of American Jews to endorse gay rights and take a liberal stance on most other so-called social issues," unquote. John Higham, in his book, Send These to Me, Immigrants in Urban America, states in clear terms that Jewish-sponsored changes in immigration law were a defeat of the political and cultural representation of, quote, "the common people of the South and West," unquote. During the decades leading up to the opening of the borders in 1965, Jewish groups had piously stated that there should be no discrimination against any group in immigration and that such could only be good for America. But Richard Ahrens, staff director of the Senate subcommittee that produced the Walter McCarran Act, pointed out the same Jewish forces which were most avid promoters of open immigration hypocritically opposed ethnic immigration they deemed unfavorable to their own interests. Quote, "One of the curious things about those who most loudly claim that the 1952 Act is discriminatory and that does not make allowance for sufficient numbers of alleged refugees is that they oppose admission of any of the approximately 1 million Arab refugees in camps where they are living in pitiful circumstances after having been driven out of Israel," unquote. Organized Jewry not only wants to prevent Arab refugees from returning to their homes in Israel, but they also oppose their coming to the United States. Do they see the displaced Palestinians as potential political opponents? So Jewish groups clearly promote forms of multiculturalism that destroy Gentile cohesion, but not those which would threaten their own group power. So clearly their dedication to multiculturalism is purely a strategic one, not an ideological one. They want groups coming into the nation which can further pluralize American society and destroy its cohesion, but not those groups whom they see as a potential political threat. Jewish-dominated political and media institutions have long promoted the demographic invasion and dissolution of America, while the Jewish media demonize as racists, those who oppose the flood of non-white immigration into America, Canada, and the European nations, Israel's immigration policy that excludes non-Jews is condoned. 1 million Palestinians fled their homes in the wake of the Israeli blitzkrieg over Palestine. They cannot return to their ancestral homeland, and many are forced to live in refugee camps that are little more than concentration camps of want and squalor. A.M. Rosenthal, the longtime editor of perhaps the most influential newspaper in America, the Jewish-owned New York Times, a hawkish supporter of Israel. He only complains about the Zionist state when it's not Zionist enough for his taste. Yet, in a 1992 editorial, Rosenthal feels obligated to criticize another country which desires to preserve its racial integrity and its cultural heritage. And I quote, "They would do better to set a quota on immigrants and nurture a more pluralist society by adopting a formula for citizenship based on residence than blood ties. Equally distressing is Bonn's failure," Bonn in Germany, of course, "to revise an outdated naturalization law rooted in ethnicity. Under the existing system, a Turkish guest worker who has lived in Germany for 30 years and speaks German fluently is denied the citizenship automatically granted a Russian-speaking immigrant who can prove German ancestry," unquote. Rosenthal likens current German immigration policies to that of the Nazis. Yet, is Israeli immigration law so different? Not only Germany, but every white nation is a target of Rosenthal's open immigration advocacy. Only Israel's immigration policy, the most draconian of all, is immune from criticism. In America, Rosenthal identifies himself as the offspring of an illegal immigrant, his father, and even lauds the immigration of Haitians, many of whom are drug users and HIV positive. Quote, "Almost always now when I read about Haitians who risk the seas to get to this country but wind up behind barbed wire, I think of an illegal immigrant I happen to know myself and of his daughters and his son myself. Even reluctantly, recognizing some economic limitations, this country should have the moral elegance to accept neighbors who flee countries where their life is terror and hunger and are run by murderous gangs. If that were a qualification for entry into our golden land, the Haitians should be welcomed with song, embrace, and memories." Unquote. As a chronic reader of the New York Times, I have yet to read a Rosenthal editorial calling for the acceptance into Israel of the million or more Palestinians who are forced by Israel to live in the dire poverty of the refugee camps. Nor has Rosenthal ever called upon Jews to welcome Palestinian refugees into Israel with song and embrace. Rosenthal is not stupid, but he is profoundly hypocritical. He knows that making full citizens of all the Palestinians currently in Israel and all those in refugee camps outside its borders would quickly sweep away the Zionist political state in the same way that non-European immigration erodes the America of our forefathers. On the other side of the coin, Rosenthal knows that Israel could not have been created but for their immigration invasion of Palestine. Looking at the historical record, should Palestinians have welcomed the Jewish immigrants with song and embrace? Rosenthal has no more regard for traditional Americans anymore than he has for the original Palestinian inhabitants of what is now called Israel. He has only one overwhelming concern, and that is Jewish supremacism. Rosenthal is proud of what he and many other Jews are, aliens as much as the wetbacks with whom he identifies. He lives here, partaking of all the advantages of American citizenship, but he will not and cannot become a real American who places the interests of America above those of the Zionist agenda. As the extremist Jews become more brazen in their exercise of power, some now boast of their role in dispossessing the European Gentile American. Earl Robb, Executive Director Emeritus of the Perlmutter Institute of Jewish Advocacy, an associate of the ADL, Anti-Defamation League of Nabrith, and writer for the San Francisco Jewish Bulletin, wrote, and I quote, "It was only after World War II that immigration law was drastically changed to eliminate such discrimination. In one of the first pieces of evidence of its political coming of age, the Jewish community has a leadership role in affecting those changes," unquote. Robb goes on to celebrate the coming minority status of whites in America. Once that's happened, he looks forward to, quote, "constitutional constraints, restrictions of freedom of speech, presumably." Here's the quote. The Census Bureau has just reported about half of the American population will soon be non-white or non-European, and they will all be American citizens. We have tipped beyond the point where a Nazi-Aryan party will be able to prevail in this country. We've been nourishing the American climate of opposition to ethnic bigotry for about half a century. That climate has not yet been perfected, but the heterogeneous nature of our population tends to make it irreversible and makes our constitutional constraints against bigotry more practical than ever. Unquote. As Rob says, Zionist Jewish activists who have supported an exclusively Jewish-run national state have been nourishing massive non-traditional immigration into America, and they look forward to the time when the voting demographics of the United States reflect that transformation. I wonder if Zionist Israel Zangwill, who coined the term melting pot, envisioned his Jewish state as a melting pot of Jew and Arab, of Islam and Judaism. Given the ethnocentrism of Zionism, I rather doubt it. One American cartoonist wrote that the problem with a melting pot is that the bottom always gets burned and the scum rises to the top. It is true that America has been a melting of the different nationalities of Europe into a traditional American majority. But in spite of the pervasive race-mixing propaganda of the Jewish media, there's been no great melting of the white and black, and only marginal melting of the mestizo and Anglo elements. However, what these Zionists have not been able to accomplish through their advocacy of miscegenation, they're in the process of achieving through massive immigration and differential birth rates. Jews have also promoted through, quote, zero population, unquote, advocates such as Paul Ehrlich, smaller families among the natural leaders of the American majority. Jewish promotion of the women's liberation movement and abortion on demand has lowered the birth rate of America's most productive and educated classes. Their blunt desire is the dissolution of the European race in the West by any means necessary. Continued massive non-European immigration satisfies these aims. In summary, massive non-white immigration has been one of the most effective weapons of organized Jewry in its cultural and ethnic war against the European American. We cannot win this life and death struggle until our people realize that we're in the midst of a war and that our side is suffering great losses. To lose this war would mean the destruction of our American culture, heritage, and freedoms. It would mean nothing less than the destruction of the very genes that made possible all the social, cultural, and spiritual creations that distinguish our civilization. Our voices are muted by mass media that are in the hands of our enemies. Too many of us are silently witnessing the genocide of our people. The time is late. We must speak out now and defend ourselves. We must fight for the continuation of the magnificent culture bequeathed to us by our forefathers. We must take whatever action necessary to ensure the future of our children and our generations to come. As is true for all living things, we must fight for our right to live. America is in many ways already occupied similarly to the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Jewish supremacists control the news, publishing, and entertainment media. They control our elections and politicians, and now they're orchestrating a massive immigration into our land that will make us a politically and culturally impotent minority in the same way that the people of Palestine have suffered that fate. They seek to make our country into a Tower of Babel in which they will occupy the top floor. Not only are European Americans on the road to oblivion from immigration, many nations are under the Jewish supremacist drive toward globalization and the destruction of any sort of ethnic or national pride and cohesiveness that could pose a threat to their hegemony. They seek to remake the world into an unremarkable mass of atomistic, deracinated individuals incapable of collective resistance to their power. If we remain silent in this critical time in our people's history, our people will be extinguished and silent forever. This maxim is not only true for Europeans and for Americans, but for all the peoples of the earth. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of chapter 13, the Jewish-led invasion. And tomorrow we begin chapter 14, a fascinating chapter entitled Jewish Evolutionary Strategy and Claims of Jewish Superiority. I believe that the completion of this book will be a milestone here at davidduke.com, and I look forward to getting the book available for download and for also sale on CD. So that's going to be coming shortly. But you've got, again, just a few more days to download these chapters as you see fit and hear them for free. I put them in your MP3 player. And I hope that all of you will work very hard to get this work, this message out to your friends and neighbors. And today, of course, with the Internet, you can help get this message out all over the world just with a few keystrokes. We've got a lot of fantastic material on davidduke.com, and I need your help to continue to spread this word and spread the truth about the dangers of Jewish supremacism. Some people always seem to ask me, well, what's your answer to Jewish supremacism? Is it white supremacism? And my answer to that, of course, is not. I don't think we should emulate these Jewish extremists, these Jewish radicals in their evil ways. I do recognize the fact that Jewish people have every right to preserve their traditions, their heritage, their values, but they don't have the right to basically suppress me and to have policies and to promote policies in power that are going to destroy my heritage and my freedom. I have a right, every right, to oppose their power. And every people has that right. Their power and really the evil aspects of Jewish supremacism are evidenced every day in the Middle East. Take what's happened to the poor Palestinians, what's happened to the Lebanese, now in two separate invasions and attacks and mass murder in their countries by these Jewish supremacists. We are moving toward a clash of civilization, and these Jewish supremacists in critical roles and media and government are leading this world toward this clash. We have a so-called war on terrorism that's only creating more terrorism, creating more hatreds, and we've got to break this cycle of hatred. And the only way we can do that is by helping people understand where the source of this conflict is arising. And of course, it's not all the problem of the Jewish supremacists, but I do believe that they are the source here. What's gone on in the Middle East, it's been sourced by the creation of the extremist state of Israel and the incredible amount of terrorism that they have wreaked upon that region of the world and also even upon the United States of America. And their power is such that Americans, most Americans, don't even know that Israel has committed terrorist acts against us, such as the Lavan Affair, an admitted act where the Israeli Minister of Defense had to resign, not because he committed terrorist acts against America, but because these acts were exposed. The attack on the USS Liberty, which our Secretary of State at the time, and he said this many times since, that he believes that this attack by Israel, and he certainly saw the documents and evidence, the attacks of Israel on this ship, which killed 34 Americans and wounded 175 Americans, he said this attack was absolutely deliberate. Or the terrible treachery of the Pollard Affair, or the idea that the Israeli lobby, which is such a powerful lobby for a foreign country, has sway over the United States of America and our government. These are frightening issues. And we've got to begin to confront these. And the first solution to this problem is simply by telling the truth. And the answer, I don't think, is for us to become evil as they are. We should recognize the preservation of our own people, but we're not trying to be supreme over or hurt any other people on earth. In fact, we've got to change our policies in the world. I do believe that America must preserve itself as a republic. And I don't think that our republic and our freedoms in America can be preserved if we try to maintain and create this empire. An empire, by the way, which is not meant for American interests. We are not in Iraq to serve America. We've got no money from Iraq. In fact, it's cost us and will cost us trillions of dollars before the cost of this war are over. It's not helped us in terms of fighting terrorism. It's created more terrorists and more hatred against America. It's not helped us in terms, obviously, of the loss of lives. Thousands and thousands of young Americans, their lives have been broken forever. Many have been killed, thousands maimed, disfigured, crippled, blinded. And this is not a war for America. It's a war for Israel. We have got to stand up and tell the truth about these issues. And again, I must tell you that things are very tough for us financially. It takes a lot of bandwidth to get this program out, a lot of work to do the things that I do around the world. And we don't have any big Jewish backers like the other side does. And we need the help. And maybe there's somewhere there's an angel out there who can help us with a large amount of money. There are certainly people in Europe and people around the world who are capable of helping this program and helping my work. But we need your help to continue. It's a struggle every day. But I will continue the struggle and do everything that I can as long as you will give me, you know, your backing and your support, because without it, I simply can't do what I do effectively. I will always do what I'm doing now, but I hope that you want me to be very effective at this and reach the maximum number of people. Thanks so much. I look forward to being with you again tomorrow.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddukeworldwide.com.